I just got to speak a little louder. How's that? Okay, thank you. So I'm Chuck Skypeck. I'm the Technical Brewing Projects Manager for the Brewers Association. And you're at the American Society of Brewing Chemists, Lab in a Fishbowl, Session 1, Yeast Counting and Viability Measurement. So I am going to talk just for a few minutes here, and I'll use the acronym ASBC, but I wanted to make sure and say American Society of Brewing Chemists. Just a couple of housekeeping notes before we go. Before we get started, please make sure your phones are turned to mute. Also, we will do question and answer at the end, and I don't see the microphones, the aisle microphones.
They're in the outside aisles.
Okay, so if you have questions at the end, please use the aisle microphones because we are recording this session. And also, please go on the CBC app if you haven't downloaded. It's a free download. And please give us your feedback about this session. So the American Society of Brewing Chemists, the ASBC, and the Brewers Association have done a lot of collaborations over the years. This is one of them. We have a very, very special one that I do want to tell you about before we get started. And that is we have a special discount for new members of the ASBC. ASBC is a professional organization, individual organization, individual membership, unlike the Brewers Association, which is brewery or business memberships. So it is a great deal. The reason we've really collaborated, the Brewers Association and the ASBC, is because, I mean, the quantity, the vast quantity and quality of the resources of the American Society of Brewing Chemists is just great resources for your brewery, great resources for those of you starting out. And we want to encourage all brewers to become members of the American Society of Brewing Chemists. So at this conference, in your seat, you'll see that there's a discount sheet there that you can get a discounted membership, $99 a year from American Society of Brewing Chemists. You can go online and register for that discount, or you can go to the ASBC booth here on the trade show. Let me look up that number real quick. Booth 9104, and if you sign up there and mention the discount, you also get a Beer Geek t-shirt. And I do want to mention that that's for new members. If you haven't been a member for ASBC for the last 3 years, that you can qualify for that discount. So I'm curious, how many people in the audience are members of ASBC?
Yeah.
Lots of opportunity there. So We'd love to see you join as members and have access to all their great resources. So I'm going to go ahead and do my duty and read the bios for our two speakers, Rob Christensen and Kelly Treader. Rob and Kelly have done this presentation at CBC for 4 years?
Five
years.
Every year we ask, Chuck, do you want us to do something else? And he said, no, people want to learn how to do cell counting. So here we are again.
So thank you, Kelly. Our two speakers are Rob Christensen. Rob is a QA specialist in microbiology at New Belgium Brewing. He started at New Belgium Brewing in May of 2016 after 10 years at Avery Brewing Company.
God, I'm not that old.
He has brewed, filtered, packaged, and tried to make quality beer his goal throughout his career in the craft brewing industry. Trained as a molecular biologist at the University of Wyoming, Rob is an active member of the Brewers Association, Master Brewers Association of the Americas, and serves on the board of directors as vice president for the American Society of Brewing Chemists. Let me get to Kelly's. If you haven't seen Kelly's picture in the app, it's great. So make sure and look at that. Kelly has been in the brewing industry since 1992, starting as a sample technician on the graveyard ship at Chorus Brewing Company. After working her way through several laboratory jobs, she served as a plant microbiologist and QA manager for a year before making the leap to New Belgium in 2008. Kelly has been active in the American Society of Brewing Chemists for 12 years and is a former member of the Board of Association for the American Society of Brewing Chemists. So please welcome Kelly and Rob.
Hello, everyone. Whoa, I'm way louder than Chuck, sorry. I'm just loud, period. Thank you for coming to this session. If I'm too loud, I'm not really sure what I can do about it. Am I good?
No, they're good. Okay.
Okay. It's loud up here, I guess I could say. So Kelly and I have been doing this for the last couple years. We think it's pretty instructive. We like doing it. How many people here are counting yeast in their brewery? Or how many people would like to learn how to count yeast in their brewery, I guess is a better one, who haven't done it? So we're going to do kind of a step-by-step of exactly how to count yeast, how we make kind of some of the clarifications on the nuances, because it's not a perfect system on a hemocytometer. But you can get really good at this through practice. And so hopefully we can set you guys up on this. And then we welcome questions. If you're totally lost and you want to raise your hand during the presentation, we can try and answer a quick question, but otherwise we'll answer questions at the end. And all the stuff Chuck was saying about the ASBC is just the resources, so we'll list some of the methods in here, and then I think we have a slide that says it, but when you leave here, if you let some of the staff from the ASBC, the wonderful Susan and Carol back here, they are going to scan your badge, and then you can get a copy of the methods from the ASBC, which you normally have to have a membership to get. So.
And I was just curious, of all of you that raised your hands that you actually are counting at your breweries, how many of you actually feel like you don't trust your results and you are scared to death to do them, or you think it's a pain in your ass to do it? A lot of people. So our goal today is to actually like give you more confidence so that you can do, the results that you get are meaningful at your brewery and that you can have confidence with your pitching rates and with your harvest statistics. So why is this important? Basically, yeast runs everything. Yeast runs your fermentations. We wouldn't be brewing beer if we didn't have yeast. One of the main things that you're going to be doing is pitch calculations, and also if you're going to be following fermentations, you're going to be doing fermentation calculations. So the big things that you want to do is pitch correctly to the recipe to avoid performance issues. So slow, stuck, incomplete fermentations would be one of the main things if you underpitch. You also want to avoid any sort of off flavors and aromas. Main ones like acetaldehyde, sulfurs, diacetyl, fusel alcohols. All of these things can happen if you either overpitch or underpitch, or you don't have a lot of confidence with your viability and you're putting unhealthy yeast into your fermentations. Another one, anybody that is actually making a recipe, you have targets that you want to hit. So you want to hit ABV, you want to hit apparent extract. And a lot of times, esters are built into those recipes, and you want to, and you can manipulate your ester profiles, by how you pitch. And then another one for any brewery is consistency and tank turnover time. You want to have the ability to predict when your tanks are going to be done so that you can produce reproducible and the same fermentation every single time. You know when to clean. We know our fat dry fermentations take about 80 hours for each of those, plus or minus 5 hours of standard deviation.
One of the other things I want to mention, too, is you guys can see we have the microscope. We have a stir plate, which is way too fast. It's our little travel stir plate that doesn't work that well. But we're going to be doing this live up here, too. So give us a second on some of this stuff. We're going to load a hemocytometer with you guys. We have to do some switching with computers and cameras and all that kind of stuff. But we'll get it in there and then go through how we count yeast pretty much on a daily basis.
I threw this in here. This is basically just a different format of how to show what can happen if you overpitch or underpitch. Anybody that has the Chris White book, Yeast, this is adapted from that. But it's a really quick guide to just show troubleshooting what can happen if you're not pitching correctly. All right, so the method that we're going to be teaching is from the ASBC Yeast 4 Toolbox. This is for hemocytometer counting. We'll go through the reagents. We are just using water up here, and a lot of times we'll just use buffered water. Don't worry about using sulfuric acid or EDTA unless you need to deflocculate something, unless your cells are clumping together.
A lot of dry yeast, especially after rehydration, are very clumpy. So we do some bottle conditioning on with our sour program. We also do some bottle conditioning on certain brands. So we do use EDTA, which is kind of nasty, to declump our yeast, and it actually works really well. So that's just something to, if you use any dry yeast, if you're using fermentis or lalamond or anything, it does help.
And we do have a little projector up here we're going to show you when we get to the demonstration of how to properly load a hemocytometer, and we're also going to show you what it looks like when you overload it. But we usually, there are multiple ways that you can load a hemocytometer. The one that we like to do is we have a 20 microliter pipetter, and we buy fine tip pipette tips, because really all you're trying to do is get a droplet of your sample at the tip of the pipette. So anybody that is using a transfer pipette, please go home and throw those away immediately, or use them for something else. And the reason why is those transfer pipettes, you don't have enough control. They'll just spit out a big old glob, and then that just will flow into your hemocytometer and overflow your wells.
Also to note, obviously you have to have a microscope to be able to do this. And then the other thing too, when we get to the demonstration, we'll show you, we're pretty specific on the type of hemocytometer, because they are not all equal. A lot of them have different counting grids. A lot of them are different quality. Some of them that are made in certain places, the grids are off, the sizes are off, and as we'll show you here in a second, it's a volumetric measurement. So if you don't have a good hemocytometer, it's not going to work well for you. They are kind of expensive, but as long as you don't break them, they'll last forever. The Neubauer hemocytometers run about $250. But you can keep them, like I said, indefinitely. We drop them every once in a while. It's heartbreaking. But it's all right. And then I think the counters, too, are something that Kelly likes very much.
Well, I brought these just to show you. You can get these, like, $2 ticket counters, you know, at Office Max. Clearly, if you're just counting on a hemocytometer, you just need one of them. When we get later into the presentation, when we are showing you how to do a viability, I like having two of them so that you can do total on one side and you can do dead on the other side. Otherwise, you can just get one of those counters that have two things on the same side. So just to show you, it's super cheap. You can get into this without a lot of money to do it the right way. So this is just an up close picture of a Neubauer hemocytometer. These are the ones that we like. We like them because you can hold them in your hand nicely. They also have these V. Do we have a pointer? I don't know if we do. It doesn't matter. There is an entrance in there for that V. Some hemocytometers you're going to get are just flat across the entrance, and it makes it actually really hard to get your sample in there. So when you're looking for a hemocytometer, look for the Neubauer with the V entrance.
And the improved bright line is what you want, too, because the lines are difficult to see sometimes on these, especially if you don't have really good microscopes. So the bright lines have very good lines on them. It's easier to see when you're trying to figure out if the cell's in your counting area or not. And then this is
a bunch of numbers.
Well, it's the most important part.
It is. This is... The takeaway from this slide is that anybody ever wonder where that 10 to the 4th came from in the calculation? Your 10 to the 4th is actually the constant, and it is your constant because it is actually equal to the volume underneath the slide. So when you have your hemocytometer, you also need to purchase the correct hemocytometer cover slips. You can't just use normal slide cover slips for this. So the total area underneath there is 0.1 millimeter cubed, or 0.1 microliter, or 0.001 mil, but that's equal to, in your calculation, 10 to the fourth. So when you're doing there and you're doing a calculation, you now know where that came from. Because this is a volumetric assay, That's another reason why it is so important that you load it correctly and that you understand that you can underfill and you can overfill. Even if the cover slip is off-centered, if you ever struggle with like one side being 100 and the other side being 20 and you go, oh, shit, I got to start over again. One of the reasons actually could be because your cover slip isn't centered. And it's a super simple thing to just check. When we're going through this, we're going to show what it looks like to go into the moat and when you're overfilling. If you overfill, you need to clean your hemodynamometer and start over. Especially if this is something, this is a count that you're going to rely on to pitch something. I was going to say pitch something important. Everything is important. Every single fermentation is important.
But that goes back to the cover slip, too. That's why the cover slip is important, because it's weighted a certain way and it's exactly cut to cover the counting area.
The counting grid. So when you look under the microscope, kind of far away on maybe a 10x objective, maybe a 40x objective, you'll be able to see all of these lines. The highlighted area in red is actually your counting area. People sometimes think that, you know, like all around it is the counting area, but you need to center in on those center 25 squares to be able to start your counting.
Yep. And when she's talking about squares, you can see the one highlighted in yellow. That's considered one of the 25 squares.
So Rob and I do this differently, but it doesn't matter. All that matters is you do it at the same time every time. I will find that upper left set of squares, and I will start up there. I will go across. I'll come down, and then I will go across, and I will work my way down like the grid shows. Rob will go up and down, and it doesn't matter as long as you do it the same way every time and that the people that you were training are doing it the same way every time. So this is where we get into where the cells are falling on those middle squares or on your counting area. We're going to go through, let's go to the next one, because all of the red are just showing you all of your yeast cells. But there are rules. So especially when you come, it's easy. If it's just a mother cell by herself, that is just one. If it is a mother and a daughter, but the daughter is really little or it's less than half the size, you still only count the mother as one. If the daughter has grown to at least half the size or is equal in size, then you will count those as two. So across the board, those are just in stone counting rules. The other one is on the edge. So depending on how you count, if you're counting left to right or if you're counting up and down, it also doesn't matter. That entire 25 squares is bordered by three lines. The center line around all of it is going to be your outside edge. When you're going across, you need to decide if you're going to count the left and the bottom all the way across, or if you're going to count the top and the right all the way across. And this is just put in place so that you can keep track and that you don't double count your yeast cells, especially if you're counting a lot of cells.
It'll make a little more sense when we're doing it live, too, as far as what you want to count and what you don't want to count.
So, as a caveat, we are brewers, we are microbiologists, we are members of ASBC, so we are teaching the ASBC method, but we also want to be super realistic about expectations. The ASBC method is asking you to count 10 full areas, which means 5 hemocytometers, both sides, all 25 of those squares.
250. That, to be statistically relevant, you
yes.
have to count 250 squares.
So anytime a method goes through ASBC, you need enough people to participate, and you also need enough data to make it relative or statistically relevant. In the real world, on a regular basis, we will probably do 2 full hemocytometers, both sides, all 25 squares. We do not, well, and I don't think anybody does because they know what I feel about this. They don't do the quick 25 square or the 5 square and then multiply method, which would be the outside corners and the inside and then multiplying. And the reason is, and I even think that there's it might be a new method that some people want to get put through the methods of analysis. So if it turns out that this is statistically relevant, then yay. But until it is proven statistically relevant, you've got to count all 25 of those. Think about it. If you have yeast, some of the yeast, and if we have time, we're going to show you, the London Ale 3. It's super popular right now, especially for like juicy and hazy IPAs. That clumps like crazy. Could you imagine if those clumps are not in, happen to be in those five squares that you're counting, you're not going to get a relevant number. So the more that you can count, the better your number will be, and the more that you can count on what you're pitching.
Yeah, it actually makes like balloon animals almost. Mm-hmm. And so you can have all your yeast on one side of the counting grid and none on the other side. And so you actually want to count as many cells as you have time for on that. And then we threw the dilution guide on here because people struggle with this. How many cells do you want to count? How many cells do you need to count? And so you should know about what your expected cell count is. So if you're counting your cells after you pitched your tank, and this is your initial pitch count, or if you're counting a slurry, the 200 million plus, these are the dilutions that you would want to use, roughly. These are the dilutions you'd want to use on a hemocytometer count. And then I just added a little table underneath for anybody who's not used to doing dilutions. So this is an easy guide to what you want to do. Most of the time, I think people are counting their slurries and then doing viabilities on them to make sure that they want to move that yeast into another fermentation. So you're going to do the 1 to 1,000. Otherwise, you're going to count way too many cells. And we'll get into how many cells that you want to count typically on one counting grid.
Yeah. And for today's example, if you have a 1 liter or 1,000 mil volumetric flask, to do your counts on your slurry is fantastic. If you don't, you are going to have to do 2 dilutions. So we've set up today to show you just the 2 dilutions already measured out. You don't need to watch us measure out 99 mils in a graduated cylinder. But when we do our dilution from our yeast sample, we're going to be doing 1 mil into 99 mils, and then we're going to, which is a 1 to 100, and then we're going to be doing another dilution of 1 to 10, which together make a 1 to 1,000. We already know to expect that this yeast slurry was taken right from production is about 550 to 600 million cells per mil. So I already knew right away we'd have to do a 1 to 1,000 to show this countable on the hemocytometer. So, helpful hint. So this is your calculation. Your average of your 10 counting areas times your dilution factor times your constant, 10 to the fourth. So in today's example, we're going to be doing, at least to show you, we're going to be doing a 1 to 1,000, but then we also have some math afterwards that uses a different dilution. The most important thing, and I'm like an old math instructor, please keep track of all of your work. I did 1 mil of sample into 99 mils of water so that if something happens, you can go back and you can check your work. I do this every single time. Because even I make mistakes, or I'm in a hurry, and then my sample looks super weird, and I'll go back, and I'm like, oh, man, that's because I added 5 mils into 95 mils. So keep track of your math, which means also keep track of your dilution so that you can do your calculation.
And this calculation works for any amount of counting areas that you do. If you're a brewer, you're in a hurry, you just load each side of the hemocytometer and you're like, I'm going to throw this on here and count these two sides and average them together and roll with it. We have the average of 10 counting areas because that's the correct method as we were talking about. But just because it's written up here doesn't mean that you have to count all 10. You could count one. You could count two. Like Kelly said, we typically count 4. We'll do 2 hemocytometers to make sure that we're correct. And then the bottom one is important too. Like she was saying, if you get 20 cells on one side and 100 on the other, you need to start over. Because technically you should be within, your count should be within 10%. So if you're doing a typical hemocytometer count, you're going to get, say, 84 on one side and 76 on the other, and then you're going to add them together and say, I've got 80 million, 80 cells times whatever your dilution factor is times 10,000.
Okay, so this is just throwing out there an example for math. It's kind of verbose, but basically you got a sample. It's a fermentation sample. It was degassed. You do need to gas it somehow. Whether or not you shake it back and forth, you put it in a sonicator, or you add antifoam. We add antifoam. Because if you don't get rid of the gas, those bubbles are going to displace the yeast in your pipetter, and you're not going to get an accurate count. Oh, thank you. So degas it. We're going to use 1 mL of sample with 99 mils of buffer or deflocculant. We're going to mix it for a while, and then we're going to load it into our hemocytometer. So all of our counting areas that we did averaged 84 cells. Somebody throw out there, what is our cell count? So the dilution is in there, just not spelled out. But somebody do quick math and just yell it out. That feels comfortable. And I'll buy you a beer later.
Wow, I'll give you the answer.
All right. So we'll just, all right, so the answer is 84 million cells per mil.
Somebody actually yelled that out.
Oh, did they? I didn't hear.
I don't know. I was asking you.
No, I didn't hear. So here's the math for that. So the average of our 10 counting areas was 84. In that example, with 1 mil of sample and 99 mils of diluent, our dilution was 100 times our standard, or the constant, which is 10 to the fourth. So 84 times 100 times 10 to the fourth gives you 84 times 10 to the sixth cells per mil. And this is really important. And if you don't understand it, please let us know. Anybody have any questions?
Perfect.
Okay.
All right. So now we're going to do this exact same thing, but basically on the hemocytometer. Kelly has volunteered to load the hemocytometer. It always makes you look shaky when you do it under these super focused cameras. So while she is loading the hemocytometer, I am going to switch off of this slide and talk about it a little bit while I switch over to this camera. Unfortunately, New Belgium's computers are not, they just don't like other people's software, so bear with us here for a second.
All right, so while Rob is doing that part, just some tricks. We did not write this down because we wanted to show you. We use, for our 1 mL pipetter, we use wide orifice tips. This really helps a lot with yeast samples, especially if your yeast have a lot of hops and trub in them. If you've ever noticed, thin-tipped pipette tips get clogged right from the very beginning. Yeah? No, these aren't sterile samples. We get sterile samples, but we would have already processed them. This is just in a clean... Oh, yeah, we just use the boxes of our pipette tips. We don't buy them bulk and then autoclave them, so they're just already sterile tips in a box. You don't. You do want them to be clean and dry, though. Yep.
Yep. And if you're buying these pipette tip boxes, too, get the ones with the filters, because if you suck a yeast slurry up into your pipetter, you're probably never getting it all the way clean again.
Yeah.
So while Kelly's working on that, we'll talk a little bit about yeast viability. So why are yeast viability measurements vital to brewing? Pretty much the same as the underpitching and overpitching. It's basically unwanted flavors, stalled fermentations, and flavor consistency. Obviously, viable yeast is important. Some strains are different than other strains. So we have some strains of yeast, and we harvest them, they're in the mid-90s. We have some strains that are in the mid-80s. We have some strains, depending upon the fermentation they went through, that'll hold on in the upper 70s as far as viability is concerned. And we'll still reuse all of those based on the generation, the fermentation before it, where we're headed into the next fermentation. So there's a lot of factors, but knowing your yeast, knowing what you're brewing with, and knowing what your yeast can handle is probably more important than just the number.
Okay, so a couple of things that I did. When you're doing your yeast dilution, we already talked about wide orifice tips. You are also going to dispense your 1 mL into your diluent, and you're going to actually wash up and down the inside of your pipette tip to get all of that yeast that's hanging on to the inside of the pipette tip into your solution. And then I also changed tips, and I'm going to use a new clean tip to load the hemocytometer. The hemocytometer also needs to be clean and dry. One of the mistakes that I see, even with our own brewers, is that beer is a sticky matrix. If they're not cleaned after every single time, then that surface will start to get sticky, and you will see that your sample doesn't... The sample should go in smoothly with capillary action, pulled into the counting area. If your hemocytometer is dirty and kind of sticky, it'll go really slowly, and it won't go in smoothly. So I'm going to show you... Hopefully, the little projector can show... what it's going to look like if I overfill this. So the hemocytometer cover slip is pretty...
It's off a little bit. It's pretty centered.
It's a little off.
And back to one of the earlier slides is that the hemocytometer, each side should take 10 microliters, essentially. So if you pull a 20-microliter sample, you should be able to fill both sides.
So,
if you get the capillary action that Kelly's talking about.
Right. So I am not delivering this volume into the hemocytometer. I'm going to get a drop at the end of the pipette tip and let capillary action of the hemocytometer pull that in. Super important. But if you overfill this, you should start to see the liquid pour out past the silver part and into the moat. If you do that, you gotta start over.
There we go. Yeah, you can see it flowing around here. This isn't a straight edge anymore. So that's an overfilled moat.
Yes. What this will also do is it will also lift your cover slip up too. So you don't want to do that. All right, now we're gonna load one correctly and we're gonna count it.
Do you want me to clean it off?
Yeah. Oh, I'm just going to go on the other side.
Okay. Yeah. I think your other side's so overfilled.
Well, we'll see what it looks like.
All right.
All right.
All right, I'm going to switch back over. Not sure why I can't. There we go. It's the wrong button. So when you're looking in the microscope at the resolution that Kelly has on there, you'd be able to see a few more cells than you can see right here.
Yeah, so under the microscope, I can actually see all 25 of those counting areas. The camera has a little bit of resolution on it as well.
It's not as focused as it was.
Is that better?
It's a little bit better. The sharpness is up pretty far. There we go. You guys think this is better or this is better out there?
That one.
This one? This one.
It's like we're at an optometrist.
Okay. Yeah. This one or this one?
Right.
Do you want to move it up just a little bit so they can see more? Oh, now you're not in the counting field. There you go.
I'll go up.
Go over a little bit. There we go.
Okay. There we go. Okay, so this is a 1 to 1,000 on a yeast slurry sample that would have been somewhere around 500 to 600 million cells per mil.
It's the top button.
That's what I thought. So this would be our first counting area. And like I said, you're always going to see these three lines surrounding your entire 25 squares. You're also going to see them run through the middle of them. In the inside, it doesn't matter. That only matters when you're doing the left and the right, or the right or the top and the left. Left and the top, or right and the bottom. So in this first one, super easy, I would count two cells. And then I would come over. Can you move a little bit?
Yeah. Do you want to run over and show them on the other side?
Oh, yeah.
All those people can't see.
Run. So those are our guidelines, or basically really our guidelines. In this first counting area, then, I would only count that cell and that cell. As we move in that direction, I usually count the left and the bottom, so I would actually count these two in this next set of squares. So we've got one, two, and then we've got these two, and then we've got these three. Since this is storage yeast, also we're not going to see a lot of budding cells. We will see some budding cells. We did bring some fermentation samples if we have time to look at. So when you get these yeast slurry samples, you really shouldn't have a lot of daughter cells. You're only going to get those in something that is maybe actively fermenting or that you're propagating. Okay. Does anybody have any questions? So far, so good. Yes, there's one over here. Well, so what we're showing is a little bit different. We're on 40, and then there's also some power in the camera. If I was doing this regularly, I would actually zoom in so that I could see what the screen is showing you, and then I would move my slide to the left and down as I was counting. If you're on the next one up, and you can see all 25 of those squares, you're too far away to actually be able to really see those mother and daughter cells.
Okay, sorry I started that a little bit prematurely there on the yeast viability. So the characteristics of healthy yeast are that they're capable of cellular growth and proliferation. It's one of the big things about overpitching. If you overpitch, then your mother cells are doing most of the work. There's enough of them there that they're not creating a whole bunch of daughter cells. So as you go into future generations, you have older cells doing more and more of the work. So you want them to proliferate. You want the cellular growth. You'll see if you propagate your own yeast, the cells are tiny through the lab part of the propagation or even in your propagator compared to what they are when they come out of the fermentation. They're almost double in size. And then the membrane integrity is huge. I know craft brewing, we just watched this trend thing on IPAs and how that's still the number one thing. Everybody's making IPAs or stronger beers. And membrane integrity is essential because you make highly hot beers or high alcohol beers and your membrane integrity is not good as you're growing cells because you've underpitched or overpitched or not put them in the right matrix before they go in there, then you're going to end up with lyse cells at the end of your fermentation and you're going to get autolytic flavors, you're going to most assuredly get higher acetaldehyde levels, and you're not going to like the product that you get out of there if you don't have strong membrane integrity. And that's another reason why you wouldn't want to pitch less viable yeast into a fermentation. Even if you're like, oh, this it'll do one more. If the viability is low enough and you've had your experience with your yeast, if it failed on you the first time, it's probably going to fail on you the second time and every time after that if your viability is not where it should be. So yeast quality, that's kind of a weird title, but we talk about viability. We just talked about viability, which is the measure of alive and dead, and then there is also vitality, which is the measure of how healthy or how active a yeast processes are inside of the cell. And so the percentage, since we're talking about cell counting, the percentage of live cells within the population would be our viability. So you should be close to 100% if you're propagating yeast. You should almost assuredly always be above 95%. And if you're not above 90% viability in a propagation, then you should probably get rid of that yeast. Something's gone wrong with oxygenation or nutrients or temperature or whatever. When we see a propagation fail at New Belgium, it's typically because we've done something wrong to the yeast and our viability has dropped below 90%, and then we start over, which sounds kind of crazy, but we've had enough experience with moving forward in our processes to know that we might get one fermentation out of that that's not anomalous, but that yeast isn't going to make it.
Wanted to add on, this is where knowing and trusting that you're doing something the same thing every time, and anybody within your brewery is doing it the same way every time, so that these numbers can be relative to each other as well. Because if you got a yeast slurry from your same yeast that you always use and you got 95% in your harvest, but then the next time you did it, it was 70%, is it because something happened in that fermentation? Or is it because that yeast was weak in some way, shape, or form? Or is it because your fermentation is just naturally a high-stress environment? Which it is, but definitely per recipe, it could be more or less stressful. So important for you guys to know that they actually are relative to each other. 95 means 95, and 70 means 70. And we can stand up here and give you guidelines on how to pitch your yeast, but it's really important for you to get to know your own yeast and each of your individual yeast strains that you use and how they behave in each matrix in each recipe that you use. For the longest time, our ale yeast that we used for Fat Tire was in the 90s. And then we actually started adding zinc, which was a good thing. But then we saw this interesting phenomenon where our viabilities had decreased. We were using 75, 78% viable yeast on a regular basis with no detriment to the fermentation. So for years, I would tell people, I would actually say that, you can't use yeast that's below 90%. But if you know your yeast and you know what they have, how they have been treated and what their life has been, you actually can if you have confidence that you actually didn't do something horrible or treat your yeast that horribly.
And there are some fermentations that you're just not going to ever be able to harvest from. If you're making a 25 Plato IPA, and I'm not joking. I mean, like, our Imperial IPA is 21.5 Plato starting gravity. We don't harvest from it ever. It's a dead end. It sucks because we actually make, believe it or not, New Belgium makes a lot of IPA and a lot of Imperial IPA, and it is that is a dead end for our yeast every time. We've tried to harvest it. We've tried to do different things at the beginning of fermentation so that we could harvest it, and it's not something that we can do. A lot of it has to do with the pure mass of vegetal hops that are at the bottom of the tank combined with the alcohol and the pressures, because we usually brew full tanks, which for us is about 1,500 hectoliters. Per fermentation, and so all of those stress factors together just make that a dead-end yeast. And then there's vitality. We can talk about that. I know we're getting kind of long on time, so with where we are. So the vitality is the metabolic activity. It's its ability to reproduce and be healthy. I always think of it as, you know, your yeast could be alive, but it's lying in its deathbed and you're spoon-feeding it, right? You don't want to use that yeast. And there are ways to measure vitality. There is a way to do it on the microscope. There's an MGNAS, but you need a fluorescence microscope for that, or you can buy a salometer. There are lots of automated cell counting devices out there that have dyes for vitality, which we do use. We use an Exelom cell counting instrument at New Belgium, and we do measure vitality, but that's not part of this.
And
so,
if you are super interested in vitality, look up the old acidification power test. It was used back in the day. It's super easy. Yeast, when it's really, really healthy and really active, will drive down the pH of your fermentation. So if you do those relative to each other, you can actually get a good indication of vitality without purchasing equipment. So just look up that, and you can get started if you're really interested in it.
So Per the ASBC method, it calls for the use of methylene blue. I think both Kelly and I both think that Tripam blue is a better dye than methylene blue. But basically, you're measuring dehydrogenase enzyme activity. So if you add methylene blue to a viable yeast cell, it will remain clear. And if you add it to a dead yeast cell, it will stain blue. And we're going to show you guys that. So this is the Yeast 3A toolbox. And like I said, there are many other dyes out there. There's a paper that we're going to cite here later in a couple slides that is going to, is a reference to a paper done by Sylvia Van Zandijk that is a wonderful paper where she took all of the dyes that are available for yeast viability measurements and compared them all together and then gives the stats on what she found. It's a great read. It'll help you make up your mind on what you want to buy. None of these dyes are expensive. They're all readily available through any type of scientific catalog or if you're ordering from VWR or Fisher Scientific or something like that. I know the one thing that Kelly would like everyone to know is that, and I think it's probably on one of these slides, is that you can use your hemocytometer for this, but you shouldn't. So in order to do this, to the method, you're going to mix a diluted yeast sample. So you're going to go ahead and do your yeast dilution, and then you're going to mix one-to-one with methylene blue dye. And then you're going to need, we usually go about 2 minutes when we do this. It's 1 to 5 minutes. And you are supposed to count between 500 and 1,000 cells, taking note of the total and the dead cells. And then it's a simple percentage, right?
Yep.
That's a lot of cells,
yep.
Like a whole lot of cells, but that's what makes it statistically relevant. If you only count 200 cells, you're probably still getting a good viability, and you're not doing a disservice to it. And then this kind of repeats some of the other stuff. The main thing that's here in red is the high range viability. If your yeast is between 90 and 100% with this method, you can trust it down to the percentage, basically. When you go below 90%, it typically errs on the high side. So if you get an 82 or an 85 or an 86 or something like that, that's probably slightly higher than what it is. And once you get down into the mid-70s and below, it's pretty much worthless. And I don't want to say, I guess worthless is a bad term, but it's not giving you the information that you want, because once more than 25% of your cells are dead, you start getting all kinds of different levels of blue, I guess you could say, where you're not getting blue and clear, you're getting half blue, and then it becomes a struggle as to what you should count and what you shouldn't count.
And just to reiterate, and Rob has heard me say this so many times, the reason I don't like, people always want to do two things at the same time and kill two birds with one stone, but you will be doing each method poorly if you put them together. So if you're trying to do viability on a hemocytometer, you are to count the cells that you should be counting on a hemocytometer, you're not getting nearly enough cells to be able to do the viability, and vice versa. So we will do them separately. Well, we actually use MGA&S. We have a fluorescent scope. But for this method, I took our same yeast sample that we used for the other dilution, and I did a 1 to 10. And then when you do those equal amounts with your methylene blue, it brings it down to something that is countable, and it's also not going to take forever to get to 500 cells.
Kelly says that it's not going to take forever to get to 500 cells. She's also like the cell counting master, so she can count cells better and faster than most people. And I've also been a brewer in a small brewery, so you kind of do what's practical, but you also don't want to do it wrong, because then you're getting misinformation. You don't have to follow the method to the T, but you definitely want to make sure that I think that bad information is worse than no information at all, to be totally honest. Because then you're kidding yourself on what you're actually doing, and you put some kind of confidence into a measurement that's not correct, rather than, you know, kind of going with feeling if you've been brewing for a while. This is the paper that we were talking about, the determination of yeast viability using fluorophores. Obviously, this presentation will be available, so you can check out that paper. And then this is how we do the viability calculation.
Yeah, so basically it's just, that's why I like using two, because you're going to keep track of your total cells on one side, and then you're going to keep track of your dead cells on the other. It just makes it a lot easier to have them independent of each other, or one finger is doing total and another finger is doing dead while they are both together. So this is, so what I'm looking at under the microscope is probably more like 100 cells. So what I would do is, in your field of your microscope, same thing as if you were counting on a hematometer, just start someplace and go in a pattern. So in this part, that would be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with no dead, and then I'd move to the middle. It's like 1, 2 with 2 dead, and then I would move over to the right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with no dead, until one side counted 500, and then you would go to your calculation and know that you can count on that viability.
Okay, I got a question for you.
Yes.
If you've got these two cells right here, are you counting that as 2 dead or 1 dead?
So he's trying to give me a trick question. So when mothers and have daughter cells, a lot of their energy are actually going to creating daughter cells. So you actually count that as alive. So thank you for that, because I did count it as dead. Since their energy is going to dividing, their energy is not going to reducing the alcohol, the dye with the alcohol dehydrogenase activity. So, trick question.
If you guys want to see any more examples or whatever, another one where the mother and daughter.
Yeah.
And there's a dead cell for you.
Yeah.
Actually, that one's budding too.
And we should, yeah. When you're doing this with methylene blue, it's going to be really good. If you have multiple people doing this, it's really good to do this side by side with somebody so that you all are counting, because it is going to be subjective. That is one of the drawbacks of using dyes like this, like methylene blue or even violet, methylene violet, is that the subjectivity of whether or not they are blue or only slightly blue. In my head, anything that is blue, I just count as dead, and then that's just it. But some people like very, very faintly light blue things to wish that they were alive, but they're not. Yes? Just the daughter cell, don't count that. But the mom, if she is dead, she's dead.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Correct. Good question.
So we just had another picture here. We want to give a little time for questions. It's already 3:50.
Oh, I know.
So this is what Kelly was talking about. Two birds, one stone, Ricky.
Yeah. Just
sorry,
don't do
to throw
it.
That in there.
Only
like one person got that joke. So our acknowledgments are, we just want to say thanks to New Belgium for letting us do this, the Brewers Association for always hosting this, and the ASBC for negotiating the ability to bring science to the CBC from the ASBC.
And I can't stress enough how important this method is. And there's all sorts of instrumentation. Rob mentioned it. We have a salometer. But, like, last year, we lost our salometer for probably 2 weeks.
Yeah, at least.
So if you do go towards instrumentation, which is fantastic, you still need to know how to do hemocytometer counts. Everybody needs to know that. And someday, you will love them, too.
And please, that slide had our email addresses on there. Feel free to ask us questions and stuff. Sometimes I feel like we roll through some of this. Just because we've both been doing this for such a long time. So it's a natural thing for us. And we also do it. Kelly and I still do cell counts pretty much every single day that we work. It's something that's very easy for us to talk through, but I feel like sometimes maybe we miss some of the nuances for people who haven't done it. So this is just to have your badge scanned on the way out to get those methods. Chuck mentioned the ASBC membership special with the $99. You can use this code on our website, or you can stop by the booth. And if you guys have any questions,
And we did want to put a plug in to friends and colleagues are talking at 4:30.
Yes.
They're the nerds that are sitting right up in front of
pH, pH and TA, acidity measurements that have to do, they're going to touch a little bit on sour beer, but they're going to talk a lot about just regular fermentations, how it affects your yeast, how it affects your flavors, how it affects all kinds of hop chemistry. And they're great presenters. They're going to do a live demo like this, too, as far as TA and pH is concerned, and promise they'll be great.
Yeah. All right. Questions? Anybody? Yeah.
So for counting viability, what kind of dilution do you guys like to use?
Like, for what like, type of sample?
Just if you're doing a viability, you like a 1 to 1,000, 1 to 500.
So for the sample that we used, I was expecting, I knew this was going to be about 600 million cells per mil. So I did a 1 to 10, and then it's equal parts with the methylene blue. So basically it was a 1 to 20. To bring it down so that you can actually like see the individual cells with your eyes on a normal slide.
And when you're doing the viability, you want more cells in there because you're just doing a wet mount and you're counting just a big grouping of cells. One thing we didn't include in here that we knew we wouldn't have time for is how to do a budding index, and it's kind of the same way where you're counting the 500 cells and you're counting a percentage that are budding and a percentage that aren't. That's also a good measurement of yeast health in propagation in the very beginning of fermentation, the first 48 hours or so. We actually use it quite a bit when we're worried about a tank.
What do you got?
So I feel like I have pretty much the setup that you do, but one thing I can't figure out, or maybe just if you have a suggestion, is the camera. What style do you have that? I mean, does the software come in it that you're using?
Oh, you're talking about this? We don't actually use this at work.
Okay.
Yeah, we just use the microscope. This is the ASBC's fancy setup for doing cool stuff like this.
Great.
We actually do have a camera and a flat screen for it and stuff, but we rarely use it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other thing, the chemicals that you're using, I feel like the amount that I use is just so small that the expiration of it is like sooner than I can actually use it up.
So get anybody who's doing methylene blue. I brought this to show you, and you can come up and get the order information. Get this liquid. You don't have to get it dry, and you can keep it in a fridge, and it stays forever. So we ordered this 1% methylene blue solution, and then you can dilute it, and we just keep this in the fridge. I kept this from last year's demonstration, and it works perfectly fine.
Yeah, if you refrigerate it. I would suggest not getting the powder.
Yeah, I would too.
I've seen a freak powder methylene blue accident, and the guy was called Papa Smurf forever. He sneezed into it in a very humid room.
Yeah.
Does the temperature of the sample matter?
It doesn't, but it should be stored in a fridge for probably no longer than 12 hours, just so that you know that the viability hasn't decreased while it's been sitting in your fridge.
For just counting, it doesn't matter at all.
Yeah, redundant,
But for viability, yeah, if you were to leave it sitting out on a counter for, 6 hours or something like that, the viability is going to decrease.
We got one more?
So when you're taking the sample of yeast, how do you guys prevent stratification of the cell counts, or do they stratify much?
So
stir plates.
Yeah, they will totally stratify in this. So what we'll do is mix it up. We'll add a little bit of anti-foam. As we're mixing, we just put it on a stir plate.
I meant more from collecting the sample from a vessel.
Well, that's a harder thing to discuss. Even we used to have impellers in our storage tanks, and we just moved to circulation loops. So if you are concerned about your homogeneity, even right from the very beginning, that's pretty tough to then know that you're getting a really good sample. So it depends on what
any
your storage tank is. Do some experiments over time. So,
can you take a sample from a sample port and from the bottom and then compare the differences and try and figure out about where you normally are? That's what I would suggest. And one thing, the last thing I want to say, too, on these samples where Kelly's saying put a little bit of antifoam, we're talking like
300 microliters.
Yeah, like half of a milliliter into a sample. So you don't dilute your sample, but you kill all the foam. We use Burko Antifoam.
We just use Burko.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's a, they're, don't buy their brewing Antifoam, though. The Antifoam 100, you want the Antifoam 10, because the Antifoam 100 is super thick. The product? It's just, it's from a company called Burko that makes chemicals for breweries.
Oh, what's the base? I think it's silica.
It's silica. It's silica based for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. They make another antifoam that's food based called Patco, and it doesn't work as well, I don't think, in brewing applications. But it would work in the lab too if you don't want to have something like that in your lab.
Yeah. That. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
You can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you have it in your brew house, it's probably Antifoam 100. You can just dilute it, too. Yeah. So.
Yeah. All right. Anybody else?
Cool. Thank you guys very
Thank
much.
Thank you guys. Oh, wait. There's one right here.
Well, we can, yeah. We can talk to it. Anybody else who wants to talk can come up here. No problem.
That went so fast.
I know. I started looking at the time, and I was like, holy shit.
Yep, I know. Turn the mic off. Hi. Oh,